Hello, and welcome to Hard Fried History, a hybrid history
and comedy
podcast run by two aspiring entertainers.
Podcast, it's more of a rant, really.
That have failed at almost everything else.
I don't fail because I don't try, so there.
We appreciate you checking us out, and if you want to see extra content, follow us on Instagram or give us a like on Facebook at Hard Fried History.
Subscribe to us on YouTube or tell us we're full of shit on Twitter at HFH Podcast.
Feel like going that extra mile? Give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. Or wherever you're listening, and leave us a flattering, a glowing review.
And of course, tell your friends, family, and even people you don't like about us.
That's right. Again, thank you for listening, and without further ado, the episode.
February 24th, 1976, a rancher in South Dakota was installing a fence on land situated along the edge of the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation when he spotted a body at the bottom of a 30-foot embankment. The badly decomposed corpse was in jeans, a maroon ski jacket, and she laid with her knees pushed up towards her chest. A coroner determined that the woman had been dead for more than 2 months. The back of her head was matted with blood. On February 25th, 1976, a first autopsy was conducted by a local doctor, and her hands were removed from her body. The cause of death was ruled to be exposure by Dr. W.D. Brown, who found no bullet wounds, and that body was buried at Jane Doe. The severed hands were sent to the FBI, to the FBI lab in Washington, D.C., and they were identified as the hands and the body, and that thus the body of Anna Mae Aquash, Anna Mae Picto, or has her birth name, or Anna Mae Aquash, a First Nations civil rights activist and a high-ranking AIM member. Her body was exhumed, and on a second autopsy that had been conducted, a bullet was found almost immediately. It was a single bullet wound at the base of her skull, which indicated that she had been shot at close range. On March 11th, 1976, the FBI took the rare step of denying that Anna Mae Aquash was an FBI informant in the Rapid City Journal. So who was Anna Mae Aquash, or Anna Mae Picto, as she was born on March 27th in 1945 into the Mi'kmaq First Nation at the Indian Brook Reserve in Shubenacadie, Nova Scotia?
So she's a boomer?
She's a boomer. She's like a heavy, like, I mean, but like.
But the, not the like type, the lame, not like a lame no. boomer.
Yeah, not like the ones who were like, I remember when I was, I remember when Martha King came to my town. Like, well, were you marching? No, I was throwing rocks.
No, I was trying to stone the man.
Yeah, I was okay, trying to, cool. I'm not talking about one of the people in Chicago who just dressed up in a Nazi. She's not one of those people. She is one of the people who fought for Indian rights and was a civil rights activist. Was at Wounded Knee. Let's just get into her life. So Shubenacadie, if Nova Scotia, I don't know anything about Nova Scotia. All I know is it's the joke in like a bunch of
yeah.
It's a joke. Like
it's super to the east of Canada, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like Maine's like Canadian cousin.
Yeah.
Like, and that's a lot. That's a lot.
I don't know anything. I don't even know enough about Nova Scotia to make a joke about it. I don't know what that joke would be that it is in. But
there's like a weird thing about like how like a lot of the like first residents of New Orleans actually came from a French settlement in Nova Scotia. This is a thing. I mean, that may be history.
Isn't that where like the Vikings landed too? Like
they landed in Nova Scotia.
All right. So I know something. Yeah, like someone, about I thought it was
Greenland, and then they got to Nova Scotia.
Yeah, and then they were chased immediately off by indigenous. They're like, holy shit, we gotta get the fuck out of here.
Yeah. So Anna Mae Picto was raised by her mother, Mary Ellen Picto, mostly. And she had a father, Francis Thomas Levi, although she would like her mother would have a second husband and third husband. She had two older sisters, Mary and Becky Picto, and a younger brother, Francis. But Anna Mae was like known as kind of like the she was the more fighter of the bunch. She was the person who would stand up for her younger brother, who like people considered that. The book said, "Let me introduce the book: The Life and Death of Anna Mae Quash by Joanna Brand." The book said like people considered her younger brother a sissy, and she would have to fight for him, all types of stuff. You know what I mean?
Well, she's the middle child, you know.
He's the middle child, yeah. So Picto and her siblings, they received like early educations on the reserve, but they like struggled with poverty through their early years. At age eight, Picto suffered from Anna Mae Picto suffered from tuberculosis in her eyes and her lungs.
What is tuberculosis like of the eyes? Because I know tuberculosis. I've heard tuberculosis of the lungs.
If TB you don't
of
stop
the
it,
eyes, I didn't even yeah, know that it, was it a spreads. Thing.
Like all this shit spreads. Like polio, like all this shit can like spread everywhere. If you don't stop it, like that's why you get a vaccine. But
that's why you do that shit. Man, TB of the eye. I can't get past that. I thought it was like TB for your lungs and glaucoma for your eyes.
If you don't treat it,
That's just the way it is, you know?
Same thing like about syphilis. Start down there, ends up up there.
It spreads. All right.
It spreads. Okay. You know what I mean?
Fair enough.
Now, I know that from books. I don't know that from person. It really seemed like I knew what the fuck I was talking about there. I know that from books and document. Okay, all right.
Doctor just told me I have 2 years. So
documentaries, not doctors. All right. to describe like what her mom did in like Shubenacadie. It was basically like they would just like hang around, like they were like unemployed a lot, and they hang around like play cards and Shubenacadie and drink and like gamble, like basically old ladies just gambling, you know what I mean, and just hanging out playing cards, like always get a little money and then taking it back and just playing cards with their friends, which is like
no knitting needles here, right?
None of that shit. We're just gambling. So her mom did have a second husband who was like more strict. They moved to Picto's Landing. He was kind of more like a strict role model in her life. And then after he passed away, then they moved back to Shubenacadie. And it's like that's when she's like getting older. She's getting into middle school and stuff, and she has like less like of a strict role model in her life, like a less strict parental figure. Like her mom's just playing cards, and like one time it's they said in the book, like she came in like, and her mom was just eating like this like really fatty pork, and like it was like just like you know, but like not no utensils. She was really digging into the fattiest of the fattiest pork, and Anna Mae was like, "Come on, you gotta stop eating that, mom." And she was like with a friend, and then her mom was like, "Nah, I like my fat." And then like Anna Mae and her friend like jumped on her mom and like forced her to stop eating the fat, like but like in jest and like in joke. It was like one of those households where it's like, yeah, I can like tackle my mom and it's fine.
Okay, all right.
It's a fun time. She eats fat. She gambles. You know what I mean?
We have a good time.
Like Dusty said, we're having a good time. You having a good time? Okay.
Having a good time. That's right.
We're having a good time.
That's like a completely alien concept to me. Mainly because my mom has like one lung, and if I were to tackle her, she might die. So I don't want to do that.
Look, well, I hope your mom.
Don't want to commit. Okay. I don't want to accidentally commit matricide. It's not
okay. All right.
On my agenda. I didn't know that was
the word, but it, you know, it weirds me out that you do, and that's like
you know, matricide. It's the same.
I never thought about killing my parents that way.
It's not the same, but you know, you switch it around.
So. In 1951, she attends Pine Tree School in Picto Landing, and then New Glasgow Elementary School and St. John's Academy. And then in 1961, she enters grade 9 at Milford High School. And she departed at the completion of her ninth grade year of school and dropped out. The reason it's like stated was like that basically in school, because she was brown, like she was like a native person, like they all got treated like shit. And like she went in like her early years at her reservation school, she was like happy, got good grades. But then she went to like the white schools, all of a sudden, like she was treated as if she was never going to be anything. She was treated like shit. So then she disengaged, like a lot of kids do.
Yeah. You know? You begin to enact that.
Yeah, of course.
Also interesting her maiden name being Pictou, and like the name of the town that she's at is Pictou's Landing. And so it makes me think that her being indigenous, they probably didn't have like traditional last names. And so whatever Canadian governmental agency just named her family, presumably after one of their founders.
That is interesting.
That's my guess.
I never thought about that. I maybe thought she gets a quash. A quash comes from her second husband, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
So, kind of moving forward, in 1962, she goes to Maine at the age of 17 for the berry and potato harvest. And like, I think it's in, like the warm summer months. And like, that which I didn't know was a thing, like that Maine grows anything. Yeah, I don't even know what Maine is.
Maine, it's okay.
I've never considered Maine. You've been to Maine. How is it?
It's cold.
Okay.
It's cold for like 6 months, and then it's like boring for 12 months, mostly. Okay. It's got some really pretty architecture. I don't want to talk too much shit about Maine. The people, I like the people because they're like crusty and jaded and kind of like my people, but you know.
Yeah, no, they're...
Stephen King's from Maine, so...
I would describe you as a Mainer type of personality.
I don't know if they would describe me as a Mainer, so I don't know.
So, when she's in Maine, she's doing berry picking and doing a potato harvest. She didn't really make a good... They didn't make... Pickers who have fruits and agriculture usually didn't make good money. All the, like, native kids, like, a lot of them would then go to Boston. And she decided that she was going to go to Boston. And there was this story about like how the people were, she was good looking. And people are fighting over, I'm going to take Anna to Boston. I'm going to take Anna to Boston. And then she picks this guy who wasn't fighting over. She picks him. And his name is Jake Maloney. And Jake Maloney is the one that takes her to Boston. And they become, you know, they become a couple. And later they'll become married.
Okay.
When Native people going to Boston was like, it was a weird experience for them because they were coming out of like this reservation life, like this like kind of like ruralish kind of life, you know what I mean? Real small community, small town. And then they go to Boston and they find that like, you know, they may have been around a lot of Native people, but like when they went to Boston, it was like white and it was black people and y'all weren't either. So everybody was like, fuck you. And it's Boston. It's like Bill Burr's dad's Boston. It's like, it's so fucked up and so racist, Boston. It's like, and it's not like the, it's not like, oh, we're racist, but we like are like genteel racist or like the Southern, like they're like, oh, they like fake polite.
Like the two-faced racism where we'll talk shit about you behind your back or an violent flare-ups will happen, but
we're gonna be a lot antebellum, like, oh, we're all polite and Southern manners, and then we're hoods and lynch you. It's not that type of racism. No. It's the type of racism where it's like, I just came from a Sox game, and I just saw two black guys, and I punched them in their fucking face. Like, it's that type of, that's my shitty Boston accent.
And I'm pissed. I'm drunk as shit.
At all times.
I routinely carry a baseball bat for either because I like to play baseball or because I like to hit people with it. It's one or the other, you know? It's a multi-utility instrument. Let me say that.
If you have Showtime, go watch the show City on a Hill. That is the show made by Ben Affleck and Matt Damon. They produced it, and it's just like it's 1980s Boston. And when black people walk into establishments on the wrong side of Boston, white people are just like, "Who let these black guys in here?" But they did not say black guys.
Okay.
They did not.
Now roll it back 20 years and you get 1960s Boston.
Yeah, those guys dead. So a lot of the times in Boston, like Indians or indigenous people would find it hard to belong. They would fall into drinking sometimes end up homeless. Anna May had like a different kind of experience. She kind of strived to like make it in Boston. She married Jake Maloney. They had two children, Denise and Deborah, in 1964. The first one, 1964, and the second one, 1965. And then from 1966 to 1968, she worked at the Elvin Celo Sewing Factory. And she was like a reputable employee. Like people, like she would get people jobs at her, at their sewing factory. And everybody, like it, it, everybody, nobody had bad things to say about it. But then Jake is kind of moving and he's trying to figure out like what he wants to do with his life. And Jake takes up karate. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Jake takes up karate. And Jake taking up karate is like, he like practices at home and they like talk about it in the book. It's like he's practicing at home and like she gets as good as him by practicing with him. Uh-huh. So like she can fight for the rest of, she's always been scrappy, but that's she can fight cool. for the rest of her life kind of on the fact that they kind of practice together. But like, also like the Jake sensei, which I only can imagine is a dude named Master Steve.
Sensei Earl.
Yeah,
Master Earl.
Like some fucking some guy who looks exactly like Bill Burr. I just think the whole city of Boston.
Master Mac. There you go. Master Mac.
He's like, hey, do you want to invest in the school? And Jake takes like a good amount of their savings and invests it in this karate school.
Okay.
And
cool.
And she was like on board, but she was trying to like back up her husband. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
She was trying to she was
support
trying to,
your man's dreams, no matter how ridiculous they may be.
She was trying to be a good wife. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh,
and
uh-huh.
And so the thing is, Jake, of course, because he's a nigga who does karate, fucks the secretary at the karate office.
Come on, man.
Come on. Because Jake does karate, and he's like, I gotta believe in my dreams, and you won't support me in my dreams. And she's like, it's a fucking karate school, Jake. It's a fucking karate school. Are you joking with me? That doesn't even make any fucking sense. You're like, it's like, then like, and like, yeah, I can imagine this just being the pit of her anger for many years to come. We're invested in a karate school, and you're out here fucking the karate bitch. Are you joking with me?
What are you doing, man? Yeah. Out here investing in Master Max Dojo. You expect me to take this shit serious? I stood by you for 3 years while you pursued this useless dream.
Uh-huh.
I don't mean to talk so much shit about people who know and do karate, because in all seriousness, they could beat me up, but come on, I don't even know, man. Here's the thing.
As a person who does comedy, I understand how stupid a dream can be. Yeah, I understand how fucking stupid.
I get it.
Jake Maloney, though, goes on to be part of the Halifax Sports Hall of Fame. And it is like one of the top karate like instructors in all of Halifax, Nova Scotia. I don't know how deep that chart is.
Well, fuck me then, you know?
I don't know how deep that chart is. Yeah, like if you go, like, there's like, you look up Jake Maloney, Nova Scotia, Halifax, karate, you find him, like, pictures of him sparring with Bruce Lee.
Jesus. All right, man. He really, he really knuckled down.
He knuckled down, but still for Anna May, it doesn't mean shit because he cheated on her with the karate.
Because he cheated on her with the karate secretary, man. That's fucked up. That's not how you do it, man. I don't know. That's fucked up.
So their marriage kind of falls apart after that. It just
naturally
does,
so, after you have sex with the karate. Kind of forces a wedge in the relationship.
Yeah. And she goes out, she starts drinking more, drinking out, and like there's like a good contingent of like Indians, or they call them Indians the whole time in the books. I'm trying to use indigenous, indigenous people in Boston, and they're getting drunk all the time. And there's a story specifically about the time when they went out in this place called the Combat Zone, which is just a place in Boston in the 60s that the newspaper would describe just as the Combat Zone.
What, just like a place, couple blocks
of bars with prostitution and stuff like that. Everything was nightlife. So they would go out over there and they would get drunk. This one time they're like hanging around, she's hanging with her friend. The friend's name is like, they called her Savage because she was like a big woman. And like the altercation with like this guy and the guy fucking stabs Savage. And then the police come And they arrest Savage when she's been stabbed, but the white dude is there like treating him like he's the fucking victim. And then this causes Anna May fucking starts getting fucking pumped up. Anna May jumps on top of a police cruiser and then jumps on top of the police. And I can only think this in the back of her mind. She's just thinking and yelling, "The karate bitch! That's the goddamn right. karate bitch!" Yeah. So she goes to jail. I think she spends a little bit of time. She goes to jail for that, just for a little bit, like, you know, scuffle shit. Mm-hmm. And this time in Boston is particularly particularly interesting for indigenous people, because this is when the Boston Indian Council is formed, or BIC as it's called. And it's formed on the basis of as an organization that she would volunteer for, and she would like volunteer as a community worker for. The mission was to promote greater self-determination, socioeconomic self-sufficiency, spiritual enhancement, intercultural understanding, and other forms of empowerment for the North American Indian community, and to assist North American Indians in obtaining an improved quality of life by providing health, job training, education, housing, and other related programs and social services. It's basically like a bunch of these organizations that pop up in the late 60s, just try to help the community, that then will get deemed communist organizations.
That will then will get deemed communists and like, disbarred and have all their prominent leaders arrested and jailed.
That they're revolutionary terrorists, and then they would, yeah. But no. So she's working with this group. She's like getting people jobs at like the Ford factory, like the Ford factory in Boston. She's like doing like workshops and stuff. And in 1970, there's the on Thanksgiving Day to commemorate the 350th anniversary of the Pilgrims landing at Plymouth Rock, AIM, the American Indian Movement, seized a replica of the Mayflower in Boston. And books have speculated that this might have been when like she first met, like came into contact with AIM. Some people say it could have happened in 1968 or 69. And Picto became also during this time. Picto is becoming involved in this thing called Tribe, which is teaching and research in bicultural education school project. It was a program in Bar Harbor, Maine, that taught young American Indians about their history.
That's cool, man.
It kind of was like trying to figure out how to teach them about themselves and also teach them, educate them. Like it was because that was like her main thing. Her main thing was education. When she comes back from Tribe, she works at a daycare in like Roxbury, Boston. And Roxbury is like where it's like the black part of Boston. It's where Patrice O'Neill is from. If you ever heard about all of New Edition is from Roxbury, you ever hear about black people in Boston, they have some affiliation with Roxbury. So she like works at like a basically a daycare there, kind of like I think it's like a daycare, kind of nursery school, kind of, you know, like a smaller kids educational facility. And she's like, people like, she's like the best. And she was so good there that she was offered a scholarship to Brandeis University.
Nice.
Just a reminder, she's never fucking, she didn't finish high school. She dropped out in the ninth grade. Yeah. And she's invested her life. She found a way to like work in a different way, and like was super interested in educating people about the history, but also incorporating that into like the greater broad scheme of education.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah, that's really cool. Cause like, I don't know, Bar Harbor is kind of a more touristy area of Maine, and it's like real pretty out there, but just thinking back to it, I didn't think of these sort of emerging indigenous movements after the subduing, if you want to think of it like, or theft of the West, being like the West, you know, I don't often think of, okay, but what about the indigenous of the East? Like, what are they doing? They're just as involved and just as plugged in, and there are different satellites such as Boston and everything like that. So it's cool to hear about.
It's weird to see. It's very interesting to like place a native person in like a Eastern city, like in all these things that we've kind of been told, like it's just Bill Buss.
Yeah, not at all.
This is around this time where she meets. I'm gonna mess up his name all the time. Nogi Sheik Aquash. And he would become her husband in the future.
Did she go to Brandeis University?
No, she turned it down because she had too much stuff going on. She was more interested in helping the community, and she was
Why should I go to school if I'm already doing the work that I can't, I need to be doing?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, but it was like a sweet. It was like she probably like felt like, fuck yeah, dude.
Yeah,
I'm not
I could
stupid.
Do this.
I'm not stupid. I deserve all that shit y'all tried to do to me. I'm actually very smart, and all that. Like, you know what I mean? So. You know, like, it's like, it's super cool that she got to turn around, like, how people treated her and made it, like, and then, like, nurtured people. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. So she meets Nogashik, and he was, like, her, so he'd be a second husband. He dresses, like, very flamboyantly, like, native. He, like, loved the beads, you know what I mean? He's fucking, you know he's native when you see him. And they're still living in Boston. And, like, she brought him home. And her mother just saw him for the first time. And she was like, oh, who fucking brought the last of the Mohicans here? I only imagine she had, like, rollers in her hair and a cigarette.
Yeah.
While she's, like, she has cards on the table. She's like, I gotta go put cards.
Eating pork fat as
well. Yeah, eating. So... they were restless, and they ended up. Wounded Knee was happening. Wounded Knee is occurring, and they end up going to Wounded Knee, which is on February 27, 1973, approximately 200 Ogala Lakota warriors or Lakota Sioux or I mean Ogala Sioux, followers of the American Indian Movement, occupied the town of Wounded Knee, South Dakota, United States, and on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. So kind of just going into the back history of AIM, I'm going to run through this very quickly. AIM, the American Indian Movement, formed on July 1968 in Minneapolis, Minnesota, initially centered in urban areas to address systematic issues of poverty and police brutality against Native Americans.
Yeah.
It's like the Black Panthers for indigenous people.
But kind of some more background on them is South Dakota and I think North Dakota, probably parts of Minneapolis. But the other book, the In the Spirit of Crazy Horse, focuses primarily on South Dakota and like Pine Ridge and everything. Yeah. And it goes into painstaking detail about how little protection U.S. indigenous had on Pine Ridge, where like the police could basically, it was almost open season. If you were a white man, or a white person generally, you could just kill an indigenous person, and there was you were gonna get away with it, you know. No recourse.
Yeah, so yeah, we're gonna get right into that. This is so again, one thing you need to know, of course, the Treaty of Fort Laramie, 1868, basically ceded like a large portion of land. We talked about this in the Crazy Horse episode, and then the gold was found in the Black Hills. We want that.
We can take that back. Yep.
Yeah. And then they restrict them to these kind of I think how many reservations in it? It's like, I think it's like nine. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I'm not
sure how many.
Yeah, I'm not sure. So on those reservations, those Sioux reservations, particularly Pine Ridge, there's kind of battles between two groups, two broader groups. The full-blooded, which is the full-blooded Sioux, which is a minority of people, and versus the mixed-blooded Sioux, mixed and white and Sioux majority.
You should use Lakota.
Lakota. Okay, my apologies. Traditional tribal elders. It was like, and then also there was the battle going on between traditional tribal elder rule and elected tribal rule. And the guy that got elected, and he was like one of the first. I think he was one of the first people like elected in this like elected tribal rule that like the BIA, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, like instituted. Was like this guy named Richard Dick Wilson. And we will call him Dick Wilson because that's what the fuck he is. He is a corrupt piece of shit. And if you go look him up on Google, he looks like the biggest piece. He looks like he should look. Like just a humongous piece of shit.
Let me see this guy.
So I'll give you time to look him up. Look him up.
Oh shit, my Google's fucking up.
Google's fucking up?
Yeah. What I do know about Dick Wilson is that he's basically like he's comparable to a dictator that the U.S. would support in the third world if you want to think of Pine Ridge as like its own country, because there's always like some weird legal hang up and it's like struggling for identity of like, are we a sovereign nation, struggling for sovereignty moreover, but because it's ruled as like a semi-autonomous province, if you even want to think of it like that. And so he would be kind of like the dictator, or the Suharto is to Indonesia as Dick Wilson is to Pine Ridge, in that he's getting all this like covert support from the U.S. government and everything.
Of course. Speculation is that the money that the FBI or the BIA was giving him money to fund his paramilitary force, the Guardians of the Ogala Nation, or as they're so lovingly called, the Goons.
Yeah.
So this kind of getting to the events that kind of bled up to
this guy got bullied.
Yeah. Look at Dick Wilson.
As a kid.
They fucking tore him down. There's some anger coming from some places.
Like, he's got a vendetta, and I think he got like called fat too much as a kid or something, and now he just wants to kill people.
He's like the worst amalgamation of like just a fat white dude with like he just looks like he's trying to be something. Like he just looks bad. He just looks angry and So kind of the events leading up to Wounded Knee. First is the killing of course, there's tremendous poverty across all the reservations, and there's like an unfair justice system between the reservations and like the states surrounding in the South Dakota and Nebraska. Let's talk about the killing of Raymond Yellow Thunder in Gordon, Nebraska. He's like drunk in Gordon, Nebraska, which looks like a town you would get beat up by white people in. It just looks
I don't want to go to Gordon, Nebraska. I'm telling
just
you.
Search it on Google Maps when you're free time, when you're not listening to this podcast, or right now, and it's just grain mill, grain mill, grain mill. That's all the Google Maps is. Grain mill, grain mill, grain mill.
Okay, cool.
Like, so he's drunk in town. I think some youth beat up and kidnap him. He's forced to dance in an American Legion hall, like in front of all these patrons, and then he's found days later. Dead of his injuries. Suspects get light sentences. They're eventually convicted for manslaughter, but they're sentenced to 6 years with a fine of $500 and 2 years with a fine of $500. The AIM gets enraged about that. AIM in November 3rd, 1972, they 500 American Indians took over the Interior Building in Washington, D.C. It was a culmination of like a cross-country journey in the Trail of Broken Treaties, intended to bring attention to American Indian issues such as living standards and treaty rights. Anna May is in attendance, so she's not gradually kind of folding into this American Indian movement. On January 27th, 1973, you have the murder of Wesley Bad Heart Bull. He's stabbed in Custer, South Dakota, in a bar. And like, there's some stories like some people say, oh, he came up to him, like he came up to this white dude, and then there's other stories about like people that are like, the white dude just said, hey, I'm gonna kill me an Indian, and then just go stabs this dude.
I've heard that. Yeah.
And he's basically charged with the white dude ends up getting charged with second degree murder, which is basically like manslaughter in South Dakota, and he like gets acquitted later.
Jesus. Okay.
So Wesley is stabbed on January 27th, 1973. The 6th of February, 1973, AIM shows up outside of the courthouse to protest the lenient charges, the second-degree murder charge.
I think that's called the courthouse riots or the courthouse. Riots.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, you're correct. This is where, like, they're basically outnumbered. Like, AIM is outnumbered 4-1 because, like, all the, like, surrounding sheriffs show up. The police advance on the crowd with batons. They're, like, tussling and, like, it's a fucking shit show. Basically, Sarah Badheart Bull, Wesley's mom, is thrown to the ground by, like, a cop. Shit breaks loose from there, and that's the Custer courthouse riots. Around the same time, the tribal council tries to impeach Dick Wilson. He presides over his own impeachment. Leader.
All right. So no conflict of interest there.
No. It's like a weird, like something, it was like a thing where it like happens. All of a sudden he ruled over it and basically like, oh, I'm not guilty.
I'm good. I'm filibustering my own impeachment. All right. What are you guys eating for breakfast? You know?
And then the tribal.
You guys want donuts? Like, come on.
Yeah. Like it's a fucking, it's a shit show. And like the BIA is just sitting there like, thumbs up during all this shit.
We got you, boss.
Yeah. And then, so the tribal leaders are angered by this, and I think it's the leaders, Oath Scroll leaders, ask AIM to like help in dealing with Wilson. Traditional chiefs and AIM leaders met with the community to discuss how to deal with the deteriorating situation on the reservation. And the Goon Squad is beating people this whole time. Goon Squad's still fucking people up.
They're basically a private police force that Dick Wilson has under his own thumb, you know?
And it's bad now, but it's going to get worse. Like, it's going to get so much fucking worse. So they're just trying to figure out what to do about the situation. It was said that like women elders or like some people that would like urge the men to take action. They collectively decided to make a stand at the hamlet of Wounded Knee, which is the renowned site of the last large scale massacre of the American Indian Wars. They occupy the town and they announced that their demands were the removal of Wilson from office and the immediate revival of treaty talks with the U.S. government. Dennis Bakes and Russell Means were the prominent spokesmen during the occupation. It was 200.
The whole time, they are like rattling the Treaty of 1868, like the second Fort Laramie Treaty. They're like, "Hey, remember this, assholes?
Yeah, yeah. We should have all this land. All this land." It's basically 200 native women and men versus 1,000 FBI. Marshals, sheriffs, and the goons, and all the government forces and the goons have ACVs. You know what ACVs are? Armored carrier vehicle. I'm pretty sure. They just have like these massive, basically like almost like tank like things, where then you can drop out the back, so they can just go anywhere. And astoundingly, for 10 weeks, they fucking hold them off.
Yeah.
And anime Aquash, and Nogoshik. Go to Wounded Knee in 1973, and they kind of cross the lines, and they're at Wounded Knee. And the only way I can describe being at Wounded Knee is like it's like it gains you the clout, like as if you were at the fucking Alamo. Like,
yeah, that's a good way to put it.
It's like you were there. You can tell the stories for the rest of your life. You were there fighting the federal government, and you fucking won. And people were thinking that this was going to be the rejuvenation of, I think, what they call the Sacred Tree of Life. Or you may know about that, where it's like all the roots of the different native peoples will come together and they form this tree that then
I think that's like one of Black Elk's prophecies. That's like Black Elk went to the original Wounded Knee in 1890, and he had like something in his vision where it's like this tree is going to grow and all of the people are going to come under this tree and unify.
Of course.
I think it's close to that. Maybe not close to that. That's what I remember. Let me say that.
Anna May has a quote from this time where she was like, "The whole country was changed with only a handful of raggedy ass pilgrims that came here in the 1500s. And it can take a handful of raggedy ass Indians to do the same. And I intend to be one of those raggedy ass Indians." First, like when she first got to Wounded Knee, they tried to tell her, "Oh, you have kitchen duty because you're new." And she was like, "I didn't come here to wash dishes. I came here to fight." And so they're both at Wounded Knee. I think they leave before Wounded Knee ends. But
I think they have like a marriage ceremony performed at Wounded Knee.
They do have a marriage ceremony performed at Wounded Knee, and it's like the guy's like, "Hey, I don't know how to." He's like, "Hey, I can only unite you. I can't divorce you. So you guys are together for life." After Wounded Knee, they return to Boston, kind of floating around. They return to Boston like with the idea of starting a survival school for indigenous people to survive in the world without losing themselves. Instead, the couple went to Ottawa, where they began to organize an exhibit of contemporary art. It was like got national acclaim in Canada. it was a big thing. In 1974, Nogoshik and anime's like relationship kind of started to deteriorate and would eventually dissolve and like end, because he drank too much, and he was a little bit wishy-washy. Like, he was kind of all over the place, whereas she was like, she was willing to be all of, but she wanted to like make like some, like she wanted to change something.
Yeah, she was more like driven than he was.
It felt like that. Also, she would like, he would like make fun of her he would like make like kind of taunt her about white women, like kind of like just being a dick, you know, like you know what I mean. And she didn't like that, especially because she remembered Karate Bitch. She remembers the Karate.
You never forget, you know.
I never forget, dog.
Karate Gate.
Karate Gate. So in 1974, their relationship ends. She then goes to Minnesota in late spring of 1974, and worked for the Red Schoolhouse in St. Paul, Minnesota. Then at the Central AIM office in Minneapolis, and this is where she begins a relationship with Dennis Bakes. And you know,
who's one of the co-founders of AIM?
Yes, the co-founders of AIM. In the autumn of 1974, she played a key role as the director of the reorganizing of the Western AIM office in Los Angeles. Marlon Brando was like a known large supporter of AIM, which is an interesting thing. I didn't know about him. Some AIM people called her or referred to her, or a lot of them did, as Banks' West Coast women. And this is where she kind of starts to interact with Douglas Durham, and she starts to, which is like AIM, which was the guy who joins AIM through the Iowa office and then becomes their like director of security. And Douglas, she doesn't like Durham because Durham is like, she always like his treatment of women. And she's always kind of confronting him. Douglas Durham was this guy who claimed to be part indigenous. In reality, he could have been, but who he was in his past, he was a former Marine who had CIA training. He was at the Bay of Pigs as a radio operator. He was an Iowa pimp and burglar, affiliated with the Iowa mob. And he was known as a crime boss in Iowa that was untouchable. And he was like a known receiver of goods in Des Moines. The police chief of Des Moines was like, I don't know how the fuck they didn't know that this guy was shady. Because we all knew in Iowa that everybody knows this guy's a fucking idiot. So basically,
just your standard CIA trained mob boss. No big deal. Don't worry about it.
Classic. Just a classic. There's more of these guys than you think they are.
It's kind of crazy. And then I don't know. And this is the guy you want as chief of your security, right? Yeah. This is your man.
Yeah. So he came through the Iowa AIM, and he was, of course, he's working with the FBI.
Yeah.
He's an FBI informant.
I mean, it seems likely. Like, this is the kind of guy you want, because he's like, hey, we know all your crimes. If you don't do this, we're going to fucking haul you in.
Apparently, he was like kind of wishy-washy, and the FBI was like, you'll ride straight to the top. And he was like, all right, I'm in.
Okay. Cool. You got just the kind of creds we're looking for in the FBI.
He was like, he destroyed the Iowa AIM chapter and basically got them labeled by everybody a bunch of crazies by like staging a bunch of shit where they would like go places with guns and like taking over like educational facilities. And like, it was like he was doing too much to where it was being labeled, like they got them labeled as like an extremist. And then he kind of moves to like the kind of AIM, like more headquarters area. And AIM, the people in AIM, like Dennis Banks liked him because he could pull shit off. He was like a pilot. He had these weird connections to money. And that's the first thing you got to start questioning. How the fuck is this nigga a pilot? Yeah. How he got the connections to money? What the fuck is it like? there's an incident where they were like, AIM was trying to not only link the tribes of America or the tribes of Canada, they were trying to link down to the tribes of like the indigenous people of Central America and South America. So they're trying to reach out to these people. And each time they try to reach out, they do it two times. Like both of the airlines that they try to go through or something, like the companies that they try to work with, both of them are affiliated with the CIA, and they like find that out midway. And it's like all Dennis, like that's like, not Dennis, Douglas that's pushing this. And like, I don't know how that didn't set off fucking bells.
Some
serious fucking bells.
Your in-flight meal is poisoned.
There's this whole thing about this guy named Robert Janklow. This is like a side story.
Yeah.
About Robert Janklow and that there's this Juan Juancita.
Is it Robert or William?
I think it's something Janklow. He becomes the state secretary of fucking South Dakota. He ends up killing somebody in a hit and run or vehicular manslaughter in the 2000s. But anyway, that guy fucking Douglas like brings, like he like basically goes and finds the girl that Janklow raped, and when she was like a babysitter for his kids.
Yeah.
And she fucking then brings her into like the brings her and tries to press charges against Douglow, like trying to bring like against Janklow, saying like, oh, he's a bad guy, he raped this girl, and like then for years, like for like time after, was like beating that girl, like Douglas Dirham was like beating that girl and like taking her out and like basically holding her captive. Is like a dick, you talk about like William O'Neill and like, you know, kind of guys like this. They're like, yeah, those guys, they're like obviously sociopaths. Yeah. They can just lie to your face. They don't give a fuck. And then they're also committing terrible crimes, beating of women, pimping. Like he's like, yeah, it's like he had like charges for like beating his pregnant wife. The guy's a dick. And then later he goes on to become like a lecturer.
Attorney General of South Dakota as well, Janklow.
Yeah. The later Douglas Dirham goes on to be to testify in front of Congress and also become a lecturer for the John Birch Society.
I don't know what that is.
It's like a conservative group that like fight, like it's like if you like yeah.
Cool.
So kind of moving forward, January to February 1975, she participated in the Gresham Abbey takeover in Wisconsin, and operated radio communications near a roadblock. After Durham's departure, because this is right where Dirham starts to leave, like he leaves and then tells everybody, "Hey, I was an FBI agent the whole time."
He got tapped.
Yeah, the Gresham Abbey takeover. It's interesting because it's like. It features like native peoples holding out against like against Wisconsin farmers in the snow, and all the Wisconsin farmers are using snow plows that they've rigged with their guns.
This is crazy.
Yeah, the Midwest is actually very exciting. Like a lot of shooting going on up here.
I've been to Maine, I've been to Wisconsin too, and I never saw any of that shit, man.
Yeah, you just weren't.
No, I missed all the good parts.
I guess. March 10th, I think the closure of the Dirham being an operative, March 10th, 1975. In the late spring of 1975, she lived, she kind of moves to the Ogallala Sioux Reservation. And she kind of lives around the reservations at the Jumping Bull compound. Mm-hmm. So at this time, one thing you need to know about this time in the kind of Sioux reservations, the murder rate between March 1st, 1973 and March 1st, 1976 averaged 56 people per 100,000. I think 170 people per 100,000 over the whole period. Those numbers mean nothing to you. Well, put this way, Detroit had a rate of 20.2 people killed per 100,000 in 1974. At the time, the Sioux Reservation, this area, Pine Ridge, was considered the murder capital of the U.S.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? So it was.
That's a good way to perspectivize it.
So the goons were just attacking AIM members, with FBI and BIA support or blind eye. They were shooting up houses. It was highway car to car shootings. They would attack you everywhere. There were some legal people who were with AIM that got off a fucking plane and they fucking sprayed the plane up. A lot of AIM members are still going to trial for Wounded Knee at this time. So FBI is like picking you up out of your fucking house, and you're going to do a grand jury, grand jury trial. Also, this is right after Dennis Banks and Means. They kind of are acquitted, or found not guilty for the Wounded Knee. So the FBI not getting their conviction there is just kind of either turning a blind eye or just supporting.
It's equivalent to what Karate Gate was to Anime Aquash. The acquittal of Banks and Means is to the FBI.
Yeah, no, they're angry. They're really angry. And they took it personally. Yes. They're not going to forget. Mm-hmm. After March 27th, Brad says the FBI agent Price interviewed Anime. After the killing of Jeanette Bissonnette, which was on March 27th, May 1975, she attends the AIM Farmington convention, and she's taken aside during this time, and people are like, "Yo, are you a fucking snitch? Hmm. Are you a fucking?" Because if there's it's like people are suspicious of her, and I think it's because the FBI is either one, putting a snitch jacket on her, which is where they basically just convince everybody that you're snitching. They just they do little shit to you to make it seem like you're getting preferential treatment, and everybody starts questioning, why the fuck is she getting preferential treatment? Because they know that you are an issue as far as like Dennis Banks' wife, because you're sleeping with Dennis Banks, all type of stuff. Like they know that. Also, people are starting to be like, hey, fucking anime, you're a Micmac. What the fuck is that?
Also, you're not even really an American citizen. You're technically a Canadian citizen.
You know what I mean? But not a lot of people around here are Micmacs. Where the fuck did you come from? They're also thinking about the Douglas Durham shit. They're like, yo, who the fuck? Who could be a snitch? And they're all thinking like, well, I don't know you. You're from somewhere far away. Are you really from there? So it's kind of this snowball that begins to roll. So June 6, 1975, Pine Ridge shootings, right? Where FBI agents Ronald Williams and Jack Kohler are murdered on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. And also a member of AIM, Joseph Stuntz, was murdered. That is a whole case within itself. Breaking that down, not a lot. People can say what happened. That's something we don't have
time. There was a very violent shootout, like FBI at the Jumping Bull compound, just like and then two of their guys get killed, and they're like, oh, you murdered our guys. And it's like, well, you were gonna kill every single one of us inside of the house. So it was like it's anarchy on Pine Ridge, basically.
Then the FBI was like, hey, you shot our guys 20 to 25 times each. And it's like, and then reality, they've only been shot like three times, maybe max each of them. Then it was like in the hand, in the foot, and then like a headshot. Now that's gonna get more to the case of like, is Leonard Peltier, did he do that? What happened with that? There's another book. We could do another episode on this whole thing. Anime is identified by FBI agent saying that she was in Pine Ridge as one of the Jumping Bull residents. I think that there's some like controversy about that she might not even have been there. July 26th, Banks is convicted in the Custer events, and he fails to appear to subsequent sentencing, and he goes underground. A lot of people are going underground at this time. Anime is arrested on September 5th after the FBI raid on Crow Dog's Paradise. She's arrested for illegal possession of explosive devices and questioned by the FBI in Pierre, South Dakota. It is hard to like know, like, because I don't trust the FBI because I've read a lot of shit on the FBI.
Yeah.
So what's true? What's being exaggerated? What's being pushed? If you read a lot about like FBI trials, there's a lot. So like, kind of saying this with a grain of salt. With a grain of salt.
Yeah.
So kind of moving forward.
Real quick, think about it. There, you look at all the top leaders of AIM, like Banks, Peltier, Means, and Anime Aquash, and there are basically three different big lightning rods of convictions you could possibly score with the Custer Courthouse riots, with Wounded Knee, and then with the aiding and abetting, quote unquote, of the killing of Agent Kohler and Williams. And then if none of those stick, you can start throwing other random pieces of shit at the wall and just trying to take down this organization through legal means. But like, you know,
the FBI at this point, they're just like, at this point,
throwing shit at the wall. You know,
we can talk about COINTELPRO and how COINTELPRO is. COINTELPRO ended in 1971, but it's with the caveat like written into it that it's like it's only supposed to be used. Basically, Hoover says, in specific circumstances, and you can argue that this is a specific circumstances that they're using that whole entire program on these
people. Yeah.
Whether
this is the most effective use of the taxpayer dollar, whether they should just come to the table and maybe negotiate with these people and address the grievances that are probably deeper and more systemic is, you decide.
Exactly. So September anime issued a subpoena to testify before a federal grand jury. September 8th, 1975, U.S. Attorney Bruce Boyd issued a memo to Anna to Aquash to ignore her subpoena. And then the grand jury indicts Anna on unlawful possession of firearms, explosives, grenades, and not registering an unlawful firearm with an obliterated mm-hmm. serial number. Like, she at this point, she just goes underground. She travels to the Pacific Northwest. And one thing about what she was doing on the Sioux Reservation while she was there, she was mainly convincing all of this, like a lot of Sioux women, Lakota women, my apologies. She was convincing a lot of Lakota women to fucking, to protest the canned goods that they were getting, because they were getting shitty canned meat. And like that's most of what she was doing, was winning the trust of women, of Lakota women, and organizing a campaign to get better commodities for them. Yeah. So, you know, she has a preliminary hearing. There's like she kind of skips town. She was basically caught up. They caught up with her in Ontario, Oregon. There was a shootout. She was jailed in Vancouver, Washington. And then she's released to return to South Dakota. She's transported to Pierre, South Dakota. They've been on the run. They kind of doing things. She gets caught. She's now back in South Dakota. And then she's released on her own personal reconnaissance by the district judge to appear for trial on November 25th, 1975. And she was at a motel, and then she just dipped out of the motel. Now, why the fuck they let her just dip out of a motel? Like, why didn't they keep her? She had been released, but, like, why weren't they, like, all this stuff, where this is kind of the last time that she's, like, she's apparently, like, seen, in the wider context, by the authorities. Yeah. And then in December 1975, she was taken from Denver to Rapid City and questioned intensely by some AIM members. And she was like at some headquarters, this is kind of like miscellaneous stuff. February 17th, 1976, a phone call was placed about a case of a hit and run near Wanby, which is kind of like in the area where her body was found. And then, of course, February 24th, 1976, the body of Anna Mae Aquash is found by that rancher that we mentioned at the beginning of the podcast. Mm-hmm. So years later, Darlene Kamook Nichols, which is Dennis Banks' ex-wife, she left Banks in the movement in 1989, and in 1999 she starts hearing that it was probably factions of AIM that might have been responsible for Aquash's death. Later, she falls in love with the first Indian federal marshal, and then in the early 2000s, like, she wears a wire. And apparently, like, this is from the New York Times, she breaks the case open, where she's like a 3-hour recording of this guy named Arlo Looking Cloud, who's a low level AIM associate who admitted that he was involved. And they said it was an environment of people didn't like anime, one, because the more established women, the wives, the people who were like the actual matriarchal force in AIM, didn't like that. There was all these women, they were fucking a lot. Like, these dudes were fucking a lot. They, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They were cheating on their wives a lot. And they didn't like that there was this new kind of like the newer, like this. She, anime was like, I'm trying to think how to say this. She was the side woman that was now trying to take a main part in the organization. Yes, she had a leadership role. And apparently, like, that kind of earned her a lot of ire. So when people like, the snitch jacket started to get put on her, people were like, oh yeah, that bitch. Of course she would. It's because convenient. Because we don't like her anyway.
I've never heard the term snitch jacket before, but it is really good, and it's a devious tactic, because there are other instances in Anna's life, or I should call her by Anna Mae Aquash's life, where she gets arrested, prior to her murder.
Yeah.
And she gets arrested and, like, hauled into police headquarters, FBI headquarters. I think in Los Angeles it happens as well. Yeah. And every time, compared to, like, some of the dudes she's arrested with, she gets low bail. And it's like, why are they always letting you off with these little slaps on the wrist?
Yeah.
And she's like, I don't know. I wish I knew, because this is like the tallest nails get hit the first or whatever, you know?
She's also like, they like in, I think it was in the Farmington, New Mexico, at like the AIM convention, where like they, like somebody put a gun to her head and was like, yo, are you fucking FBI? She's like, if you think I'm an FBI agent, fucking blow my brains out right now. And they don't end up doing it. Like, she was dedicated to the cause.
Yeah.
Like, extremely dedicated.
But the FBI's thinking, if we can turn enough of the leadership against her, we can isolate her, and then maybe flip her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the Pirate Patrol is like the matriarchal women. They don't like her, of course, for the reasons they said before. And then people are saying, there's no way these low-level AIM associates could have fucking just killed her. They wouldn't have done that without leadership involvement. Mm-hmm. Or somebody said giving the go ahead. That's what it's all. Of course, this is of course that's more the hearsay part. Apparently, in the 2000s, Namook talking to Arlo Looking Cloud, she kind of urged him to cooperate with She urged him to cooperate with the authorities. Eventually, he confessed and took the stand against John Graham, another AIM member. Naming him as the gunman, and he kind of stated it was getting kind of blew out. It's from the New York Times. Looking Cloud testified, recounting how they marched Aquash at dawn into the grassland off South Dakota Highway 73 and put a pistol to her head. She started praying. It was so quick. The men were tried separately for the murder. Looking Cloud in 2004 and Graham in 2010, both were convicted. And it's kind of like a eerie, because if you look at 73, like South Dakota 73, it's just the plains, and it's just it's cold, probably snowy, and it's a really sad end to somebody's life. And it's also sad end to somebody's life who was just striving for the best for people, but also a sad end to, like, if you look at the reservation now, the states of the Pine Ridge Reservation, it's one of the poorest Indian reservations or indigenous reservations in the country, with a per capita income of about $4,000 and an unemployment rate of 80-90% per the New York Times in 2014. So, you know what I mean? It's a story. I don't know, man. It's a story about people striving for the betterment of themselves, right? Yeah. But then also on the back end, like, the story about how, you know what I mean, the FBI can then get in your shit, and then I'm not trying to take any blame away from the AIM members. Then it's like, yeah, like, and then the paranoia that can then destroy whatever you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's a lot here, because then, like, the FBI tried to cover up, like, that's why they have that hasty ass first autopsy.
Yeah.
I think that's what it's suspected. And they, like, they go as far as to cut off her hands.
Yeah.
As a means to identify it. And it's, or like, some are saying that they cut off her hands in order for her not to be identified. And they, like, ship them away because they didn't call in the family to identify the corpse, even though it was still in relatively good condition.
Yeah, there's people. Somebody I think in the beginning I said it was badly decomposed. That's kind of controversial.
Yeah.
Some people say it was. Some people say it wasn't. But then also
they pulled in a second doctor, and after they exhumed the corpse, that way they can do the second autopsy. He's like, even after we exhumed it, it was still fairly good, you know. So that might have been just bullshit that they were just throwing out there.
There's also like the story about like the people who were at the first autopsy, and when the body was discovered, there's a bunch of BIA agents and there's a bunch of FBI agents, and they all knew Anna Mae Aquash, and they all knew who the fuck she was, and they were like, oh, we couldn't identify the body, and that's why they're saying why it was badly decomposed, because they were like, oh, we couldn't identify it when they knew this woman by sight. And they had been tailing her and, like, trying to play this game between all these people. And, like, it's reasonable to say, like, the FBI, like, might have thought, like, yeah, we got fucking Dick Wilson running around over here
with the fucking goons. Yeah, Dick Wilson probably did this.
And, like, that he fucking popped one of these people who just killed this girl, this lady with no, like, and, but, like, even in that, like, I mean, yeah, then they're like, oh, we're just going to cover it up.
But it was really the snitch jacket that they put on her.
Yeah.
That led to her death because the paranoia that was generated from
Again, some people who are like more AIM, like people who are like maybe associated Native Indigenous people are like, nah, that didn't happen. That's bullshit. Kamook, you fucking then married a fucking federal marshal. Mm. So this is all made up and conjured by Kamook. Okay. You know, like, yeah. I wasn't there. I don't really know, this is what has, that's what a court case and a conviction is. Like there's a conviction.
Another thing real quick, about the Black Hills generally and why the struggle is continuous is because in the 1870s, it was gold that white people wanted from the Black Hills. Yeah. And in the 1970s, it was uranium. Because we're in the middle of the Cold War, we're in the middle of the arms race, and there's a lot of uranium inside of the Black Hills, and we need that to make nukes. So just switch from one resource to another, you know?
It's not, I want to be like, reading a lot of history, you learn about, it's like about the material things, it's about the capital, but... Yep. Then in the kind of book, in the life or death of Anna Mae Quatsch by Joanna Brand, she was talking about how like analysis of the COINTELPRO program, it was also, it was about maintaining the economic system or, you know, maintaining like wanting to maintain the order, but it was also about maintaining the, like, they want to maintain law and order, but also maintain the social orders of places.
Yeah.
So I don't know, man. It's an interesting story. It kind of has the FBI, I think somebody was saying in the book, like the FBI kind of came in and they were like running around like they were playing cowboys and Indians, except those were real bullets and were real Indians.
Yep.
That's fucked, dude. But yeah, man, it's an interesting story. Rest in peace, Anna Mae Quatsch.
For real.
Anna Picto Aquash. Definitely, give this a read. It's a very good book. This is love good parts in it. In the spirit of Crazy Horse, very good book.
Mm-hmm.
Guys, that has been our Anime Quash episode. Thank you guys for listening. Who do we have next week, Henry?
Next week we're looking at the murder of is it Ariel Franco or Mario
it's
Franco?
Mario Franco. I'm pretty sure it's Mario Franco. Franco.
Yours again. I don't know anything about this.
Yeah, no, I mean it's a Brazilian social activist and congressperson that was murdered by a militia, a right wing militia. LGBTQ plus congressman. Especially in Brazil, which Brazil okay.
Whole nother Brazil.
Brazil.
It's not that happy always.
No, man. Samba is not reflective.
Samba's one side. Yeah. Right wing goon squads with masks are another side.
Another side. Guys, you can follow us, like us. We share all our stuff.
Mm-hmm,
You can follow us at Heartfire History on Instagram and Facebook, HFS Podcast on Twitter, Heartfire History on YouTube. You can follow me at Joshua B. Stokes on Instagram and Twitter and Joshua Stokes on Facebook. Henry, where can they find you at?
I'm just Henry E. Price on IG and Henry Price on Facebook.
Guys, we want to thank you for listening, and we love you. We'll see you next time. Stay safe out there. All right? Peace.